and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous director, writer, producer. I don't know. He's going to get into it while he was here. His film Reality Queen is fantastic. It's got a really cute model at the beginning. And she's throughout the film and some great character actors and some actors you're going to recognize and one sports figure. Stephen J. Bernheim, welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start. I mean, while watching this film, obviously I recognize a lot of stuff from the tabloids, and I recognize your lead, who she should be in my world, but she could be a bunch of different characters, which is fine. Now, are you a reality junkie, I guess is my first question.
No, I'm the opposite. I'm somebody who's not really the biggest fan of this trend of having people with no discernible talent or understanding of the world be idolized and make $1 billion. I don't think Kylie Jenner should be a billionaire.
She's a little
based
help.
On contributions to society.
Well, okay, so your film is an attack back against, a backlash then. You're saying, okay, look what we can do.
Yeah, it's kind of a back, it's a parody, it's a satire of something really dumb. I mean, I was very inspired by This is Spinal Tap, right?
Okay.
This is Spinal Tap is a parody of these morons who went around making what they called music in the late 80s, you know, hair metal bands. And the guys I know, that everybody I knew who had a garage had a band, or his mom had a garage. And they weren't talented, but yet, you know, they made millions and billions of dollars, and everybody, you know, acted like they were. And so you know, Rob Reiner and Christopher Guest and those geniuses said, we got to make fun of this because they're so stupid. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Fair enough. So where did this idea come? You just got sick of watching reality stars, too much Kardashian
news? You know, what really triggered it was, you know, just somebody I was following, a little bit of a following. It was a woman. It's actually, believe it or not, Jose Canseco's daughter, for some reason. I was like following her, right? And she was like 21. She's like a model. She's pretty smart though, right? And she said she was at Coachella. And she wrote this whole essay about seeing Paris Hilton at Coachella in her late 30s, dressed like a 19-year-old, you know, with the festival clothes and all that stuff. And this young woman, model, you know, that really belonged there because of her peer group, was just saying, you know, it's just so embarrassing. And she looked so ridiculous and so dumb. And what is she trying to prove, you know? And that kind of triggered in my mind, you know what? People like that really need to be made fun of. And then separately, I had I was next door neighbors for 12 years with the person who Winston Spritz in our movie is based on, which is Elliot Mintz. He was my next door neighbor and became a very close friend of mine. And Elliot was kind of, for, you know, a decade, Paris's crisis manager / publicist / babysitter. You know, he was the guy who would have to, you know, in his 60s, drive them around and take them to all the clubs and stay out till 5 a.m. at after parties. And then when they would get drunk and in a fist fight with each other, he would have to go to TMZ cameras and say, Paris and Lindsay are still the best of friends.
Ah.
Although Paris's lacerations are being treated, you know, like that. And so he would tell me, you know, and it threw his whole sleep pattern off and, you know. So I said, you know what, this is ripe for lampooning.
Oh, absolutely. And you do a good job of it. I mean, you do lampoon little doggies.
We do. Well, their desire to have they got to have the world's smallest dog, of course, because it is it's a fashion accessory, not an actual living creature like the rest of us think of as a dog. Because remember, these are the most narcissistic people on earth.
And I mean, you also lampoon their book writing. Which I thought.
Yes, they don't write their books, and in our case, she doesn't even know what an autobiography is. She thinks it must have something to do with cars, autos.
You lampoon their friends. I mean, you've spared no expense to lampoon everything.
Well, the thing I think I'm lampooning the most, though, is us, the rest of us, the public, because we are the ones who, through my stupidity and that of others, you know, empower them by supporting them and buying all their nonsense and their products and their 50 fragrances that smell the same and all have, you know, ridiculous, sensuous names, you know, and without us, there would be no them. So really, that's what, at one point, London says, the American public doesn't know what it wants until it's told. So, you know, I'm making fun of us too.
I have to agree with you. I don't know, but I mean, what they're doing works. I mean, it's right. Obvious. They're multimillionaires. I don't buy their products. They're not selling to me, so I don't know who they're selling to.
Well, the rest, they're selling to us with a capital U, you know, in general. I mean, you and me may not necessarily buy something they're selling, but people are, and, you know, the broad public is, and, you know, we probably shouldn't be giving them the credence that we do, is my view. But also, you know, they're not completely dumb. Because, you know, and we make the point that they have a certain brilliant instinct about them in terms of manipulation.
Oh, I agree. I'm with you 100%. And I think you totally show that with her competitor, Kimmy.
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, I like the way you lampoon that because I agree with it. I think it's gotten to a point that is just ridiculous now. Like, I don't understand why anybody would pay attention to these people.
Yeah, right. And at the end, London says exactly that. She says when she's, you know, finally bearing her soul, she's saying, look, I don't know why people buy my products. Yeah. You know? I just know they do.
So let's get into a little bit more. Like, you have 8 writers on the film, which is a lot of people to write. Now, how is that to struggle? Is that hard to work with?
No. And it was all intentional. As I said, I'm a big fan of this is Spinal Tap. Right, and that film was largely ad-libbed, and they even gave writing credit to the actors. Now, where I was inspired was television writing. I'm a former editor of the Harvard Lampoon, and a lot of my friends went on to write TV. I was on Lampoon with Conan O'Brien and some of the original writers on The Simpsons. And what I learned on the Lampoon was that comedy writing is in contrast to drama writing or any other type of screenwriting, is really best when it's a collaborative effort. And you know, that's why, you know, the basic process, like on The Simpsons or any sitcom, is the head writer / producer assign, you know, comes up with, or maybe with a group of the producers that come up with the concept for that episode. Then they assign it to one writer or one writing team, just to do a very rough sort of basic skeletal draft. And then, you know, they sit around a writer's table, you know, all 8 of the staff, you know, for weeks, and work on it and punch it up and do new scenes and, you know, and bounce off each other. And there's actually literally a writer's assistant taking notes, you know, what everyone's saying. And, you know, and then there's, I guess, you know, sort of a head writer, sort of the adjudicator, you know, if there's disagreement on something being a good or bad idea. And that's what I wanted to do. So what we did was, my plan was I would get a skeletal script based on my notes from one writer. Then we would have a writer's room for a month where we would punch it up, do little scenes, you know, et cetera. And then, and I would decide, you know, what I liked, what I didn't. And then maybe give it to one or two more writers at the end to just add a few jokes, put some ornaments on the tree, you know. And then allow the actors to ad-lib. And that's what we did.
Now, when you were spicing up your film, did you have planned to hire Janice Richards, Mike Tyson? I'm going to be in trouble.
Yes.
John. Oh, God.
Witherspoon. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes to all 3. Well, you know, Denise, yeah. I mean, I always can I be very honest here? Don't put this in the interview. But, yeah, I just had a big crush on Denise Richards from when I was, you know, been watching her at age 12 on Starship Troopers or whatever, you know what I mean? So then when we were sort of – we knew that we wanted to have a famous, like, celebrity actress – as London's best friend, you know, because they always have some celebrity friend, you know, and so, you know, we had different ideas, and we kind of wrote it for Denise Richards, but I was like, you know, if we can't get Denise Richards, there are other candidates. It turned out we had multiple candidates, but luckily Denise Richards wanted to do it. The one caveat is we wanted, you know, like Mike Tyson, we wanted her to use her real name. We wanted to really be Denise Richards because it's a mock documentary. So the more reality we can have, you know, the better it sells. But Denise wanted to have a character, you know. But it was still built around her. Like, you know, one of Denise's main things is considering she's a big celeb. Now she's on, you know, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills stuff. She is a mother, and she's a very good mother, and she's got her own two kids that she had with Charlie and then two of Charlie's kids that she takes care of. So we built that into her character too, you know. You know, and she's very grounded, I mean, for a celebrity and stuff. So, yeah. So, and then Mike Tyson, from the beginning, we wanted the sex tape to be with Mike Tyson, you know, because we had this funny visual of, you know, well, what if London bit off Mike's ear, you know, during hot sex and stuff. And but we knew we had a sex tape because that's how, you know, Kim Kardashian and Paris Hilton and others have become famous.
Oh, I'm with you. I'm totally with you. Now,
John Witherspoon was because I'm a huge fan, hugely influenced by the Friday movies.
I thought
And John, I wouldn't go in there for 30, 45 minutes. You know, I just loved him. And I said, I got to work with him. So we created a character for him. And he was brilliant. And tragically, this is his last feature film.
I was thinking that, which upset me because I love him. I also want to throw one of your – I think Denise Richards says herself, Tammy and the T-Rex, the stalker says it. I was like, who else has seen that film besides me? I was shocked when that came out.
Yeah, Tammy and the Brontosaurus. And what we did was we, do you know that it's actually being re-released on Blu-ray?
It's out.
Blu-ray is coming out.
It is out now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, right, because we wanted it to be Denise, you know. And it would have been, I think when we originally wrote it, because we were hoping she would play herself, it would have been, have you seen Tammy and the T-Rex? But, you know, we had to change it because she wanted to play a character.
I just thought that was funny. I mean, that's just a weird film to bring up, that if you don't know what it is, the joke would have gone right over your head. It made me laugh.
Well, there's something in there for everybody. I mean, my feeling in writing jokes is, you know, you have some jokes that everyone's going to get. But you also want to be, if you're going to write smart jokes, not everybody's going to get them, but some people will get them. So you write for just different people, you know.
So when you're doing the Spinal Tap thing, which you're obviously parodying, so is that why you went with a British journalist, just to give us that feel?
Yeah, in part because to give you that feel. It was sort of the reverse, because this is Spinal Tap is an American guy.
That's what I figured, yes.
You know, really dumb Brits, and this is a Brit observing really dumb Americans.
Yes.
That's part of it. But the other part is I was very influenced by, first of all, every Stanley Kubrick movie, but in terms of comedy, Dr. Strangelove. I think it's one of the greatest, you know, top three comedies ever made. And really, there's a character there played by Peter Sellers, who plays three characters, Group Captain Lionel Mandrake, you know, and he's a very proper British, you know, guy. And then his superior officer is this American who's going insane and going off to start nuclear war. And Mandrake's kind of understated sort of reactions to me are hilarious, you know. Except at one point he kind of loses it, but he's just so, you know. He's got to play along in this British way. And so I actually, you know, sort of imitated that whole character for our actress, Kate Orsini, and so that she could pick up on it.
And her parents?
So that's the other end.
London's parents, where do they come from?
Well, they're supposed to be, you know, the Hilton's Rick and Kathy.
I was wondering if they were. I was like, I'm going to have to ask.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and I mean, they're not, you know, exact parodies, but you know, they're sort of the rich, you know, entitled, you know, parents who actually themselves inherited money, you know, and they drink and party, and you know, but they know that their daughter is a complete imbecile, you know.
Oh, they definitely know, and they definitely know. Yeah. I don't think there's any surprise with that. You seem to go a lot of work. I want to discuss London's pillows with her face on it.
Yeah, that's true. Apparently. Well, Denise Richards actually told me that, you know, she's been to Paris's house because Paris lives in Mulholland Estates and Charlie Sheen lives in Mulholland Estates. So they were kind of neighbors when they were married, when Denise and Charlie were married. She's been there and she told me Paris has got all these pillows with pictures of herself And she has a life-sized portrait of herself. And that's why we have a life-sized portrait of London and all those pillows. You know, it's the narcissism that we're trying to parody, of course.
Yeah, you don't know nothing. Now, we've left London alone. Now, where did you find your London?
Well, she auditioned along with a lot of actresses, right? And, you know, as a director, I really feel like my number one job is to get the right cast. You know, the quality of acting for a smaller film in particular is everything. I mean, you might can have a little bad lighting here. Maybe you don't frame a shot right. You know, maybe you've got some other problems. But if you have bad acting or a bad performance, even one bad performance, that's it. Your film's shit. So I read lots and lots of people for every single role. And the best actor got the part. So Julia Faye West was the best actor by audition. However, I do have to say, she's not a stranger. I'd known her from before. I knew her from the fact that she was my ex-wife. True story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was once married to her, so I knew she was a good actor.
Well, good. Wow, I had no idea. There's something new.
That is not why she got the role.
That's fair enough. Well, wow.
I mean, if anything, you don't want to really spend a lot of extra time necessarily with your ex-wife. Especially if you have Denise Richards on the set.
That's true. Wow, sorry, that just blew my mind there. Where did you find – did you have to rent the mansion or did you borrow the mansion?
No, rent. I mean, the mansion is the Pasadena Princess, which is the largest house in Pasadena, which is very old money part of Los Angeles. And it costs a fortune to rent it. But we wanted, you know, all the exteriors of the mansion are shot at the Pasadena Princess. Now, the Pasadena Princess, though, is in the process of renovation. That's interior is gutted. So we found another mansion in Calabasas, actually not far from where Kim lives, and use that as the interior.
Okay, so you have two different
really
hotels.
Two mansions combined, and just, both were expensive.
So when you go to rent something like that, do you just go online, or do you know somebody, or how does that work?
Well, you go to location rental, location scouting companies, and they set you up with homes and houses that are used for sets. Like a lot of stuff's been shot at the Pasadena Princess, for example. Now, actually, though, in looking for the interior, it was actually our producer, Greg Lindsay, who happened to know the owner. But we still had to negotiate a pretty major price because she'd rented it out for other things.
Okay, fair enough. Now, you also have things like a nightclub, you have a bookstore, you have a hospital room. Are those all rentals, or do you know the people?
Yeah, no. Every single location had to be rented, and the nightclub is a real nightclub in Hollywood called the Avalon. It's a huge nightclub, and we rented the Avalon for two full days, and again, it wasn't cheap. And then the Lumberjack Bar is this little bar that we redecorated in the second floor of the Avalon nightclub. The hospital is actually a fixed hospital set, at Silver Dream Studios in Orange County. And, and the bookstore is a very famous, entertainment bookstore that we rented called Samuel French. I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but in LA it's famous. Yeah.
I trust you. Now, I thought maybe
that first mistake.
I thought maybe the lumberjack scene was a throwback to Python. Was that the option?
Yes. Absolutely. He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day. On Wednesday he goes shopping and has buttered scones for tea.
That's what I was thinking, that whole scene.
But we also, again, going back to Kubrick, we parody Eyes Wide Shut, because at the end we have the lumberjacks in this like sexy eye, wearing the eye shut masks. I don't know if you caught that, but yeah.
I did, but I'm like, I don't know, because I thought that might be a little heavy going Eyes Wide Shut. I'm like, I'm just going to leave that
alone.
But it's
a parody because, you know, it's something sexy. So we're, you know.
Okay.
I don't know. It's just goofy, you know. And also, you know, just, I mean, I'm in love with comedy movies. So any, you know, I mean, there's a lot of homages. Like the character, Simon DeBrie, that is an homage to the producers, to Mel Brooks, because he named his director, the worst director on Broadway, Roger DeBrie. And I just always loved that character. And I think the character names in comedy are really important.
So we did forget to mention Charles Fleischer doing his Beth Larry King impression.
Yes, yes, he did a great impression. I've made another movie with him called The Backlot Murders, which is a horror comedy. I didn't direct it, but I was a creative producer and screenwriter. And Charlie, you know, he was not only a great stand-up comic, he then is the voice of Roger Rabbit.
I know.
Yeah.
I do know that. When you are getting this film together, like, do you self-produce this or do you have producers, or how do you go and get the money?
No, we had producers, you know, a head producer, very, very experienced, great guy. It's actually Shane Black's best friend, or one of his best friends, Greg Lindsay. And Greg's also an actor, and he actually is a writer, too. So he wrote, and he plays the Catal, Julius Catal character, which is a parody of, you know, the dog guy. Blanking on the name, but you know, the foreign dog guy.
Yes, I know exactly who you're talking about in the film.
Yeah, right. So he was the main producer. We had two other producers. So we had three producers, and we had, you know, what's called a line producer, and we had a production coordinator. So really five heads of, you know, five sort of administrative producer types, and then after that, you've got all their staff. I mean, it was amazing. It's a huge crew. Huge budget. I mean, for an indie, it was a big budget.
Yeah. We haven't discussed your music. Green Light, Always Going Up and Down.
Yeah.
I love the song. I think the song really works for the film.
It's a great song, right? Yeah, well, I hired a really – well, here's what happened. You know, I thought we would have a score, right? So I hired a composer. I will not mention his name. But he just didn't get it. And the score was just, you know, awful. And, and I also had a music – what do you call it? Music coordinator, is it? I guess, or whatever, the music supervisor. That's the title. And the music supervisor, this composer is not getting it. You know, I'm giving him notes. He's not adjusting the notes. So what I want to do, he said, is get rid of the composer. So I had to eat the production had to eat his contract. And then he just said, look, I'm just going to use bands. I'm just going to use music. We're not going to have recorded music. We're not going to have a score. And I'm like, okay, great. And then he found all this music, and that guy picked everything. I didn't pick any of the music. I liked it. He gave it to me for approval. I said, it's awesome. You know, he did a great job.
And I would feel bad if we didn't mention Stalker Steve.
Yeah, that's right, Steve Brock.
Now you must know this guy. I can't see him being on a casting call. He looks like a friend of yours.
No. He was at a casting call. We had a lot of guys.
Really?
Yeah.
Because he looks like a stalker.
Well, that was the idea.
Perfect.
Thank you. I'll take that as a compliment.
It was a total compliment.
Like I said, cast. Well, you know, I mean, I spent months casting this.
Okay. How many months did you spend casting it then?
Well, almost two. I mean, you know, seven weeks of casting.
Well, that's good. Okay. Now, at the end of the film, we have a redemption of some kind.
Yeah, well, it's sort of a reveal more than a redemption.
Okay, a reveal. Yes.
It's a reveal that, you know what, she's not as – she may be dumb. She may be ignorant. She may not be high IQ. She may not know anything about the world. She may think that London is a country, you know, as well as a name for her. But she is clearly a schemer. You know, she is somebody who can manipulate her way through the world, you know, and in that sense, she's bright. And that's what's revealed. She's, you know, planned all this. She had made a deal with her rival, which is frankly what good business people do, right? You know, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yes.
You know, do a deal with them, right? So, you know, she got this bit of dirt that the woman was, you know, that Kim was faking a pregnancy. for the reason that if you fake the pregnancy and use your large sister as a surrogate, then you can immediately lose the baby weight and brag about it and make a lot of money on whatever products. So she found out. She says, well, look, I'm going to blow this for you, or we could just work together on a new show.
Yeah.
And of course, that's what she, you know, had been scheming all along. And then the purpose of this documentary ultimately was to promote the new show.
There we go.
So it was all a scheme.
Now, did you take your film to the American Film Market, or did you take it film festival?
We did. We did. That's how what we got. We took the film to the American Film Market, right? And there, I got a foreign sales agent, or let's call it a sales agent, called House of Film. A really good indie, you know, they really support indie artists, do a great job, signed a deal with them. Then they got the deals, you know, with different foreign territories, and then also made the deal with High Octane Pictures to do the domestic release.
So, do you think it eventually will end up on Amazon, or is it on VOD, or where did they find it?
Well, this is getting a 20-plus city theatrical release. It's going to be in theaters January 10th in L.A., New York, Chicago, Detroit, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, Austin, Miami, Orlando, Milwaukee. It's going to be in, I gave you some of them. Milwaukee is another city. Miami, I don't know if I mentioned that one. It's going to be in more than 20 cities and major cities.
That's really awesome.
In theaters.
Is it being released in Europe too, or just North America?
Yeah, it's they've sold the rights to it to the entire United Kingdom. So that's England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland. It's been sold to China, and it's been sold to all of Latin America. So that's, you know, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Peru, Colombia, Venezuela, all the Latin American countries. So right now, that's where it's available, or will be. And then in the U.S., in addition to theaters, on January 10th, it's also going to be coming out on cable TV and satellite TV.
So you're a rocket. So I guess our last question is, before we get to our fun questions, if you could add something to your film, since it's based on reality and things happen, since you finished your film, is there something you wish you could have added?
You know, I like I mentioned, I started with a 2-hour cut, and I had to cut some really funny stuff out. I mean, there was a lot of phenomenal ad-libbing by some of the actors. I mean, that there just wasn't room for. So, you know, I mean, just more comic bits is pretty much what I would say if I had more length. But maybe it's better this way because it's tighter, you know, when they forced me to take half hour out of it. Maybe it's better. That's what they said.
Okay, well, now we're off to the fun question part of the show. What film made you want to be a director?
Well, you know, I always, like I said, I was a class clown. I loved comedy. So I wanted to make funny films. Ironically, I ended up producing primarily like B action, B horror, stuff like that. So I didn't get the opportunity. But as far as, you know, it was comedies that made me want to be a filmmaker. And I mean, since I was a little kid, I loved The Producers. I mean, I've been watching that movie since, you know, I was whatever, 10 years old. This is Spinal Tap, I think we've mentioned. Dr. Strangelove is a film that, like, I'm in love with. The Three Stooges, you know, were an influence. The great comedies made me want to be a director at a young age.
What's the last film you saw in a theater besides your own?
Oh, sure. Well, I go to the theater a lot. I just saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I loved it. I thought it was amazing, one of those films that I kind of wish I had made, because it's really a comedy. I mean, kind of like Kill Bill. It's got action, it's got some drama, but it's I think it transcends genre, but I loved it. I tried to see The Irishman in the theaters, but it was in such a limited theatrical release. I had to watch it on Netflix, and I didn't care for it at all, I have to say. It's a small minority of critics that kind of agree with me. I think it's the Emperor Has No Clothes syndrome. I think that what it is a bunch of, filmmakers and actors that were once great, they're now way past their prime, and instead of trying to be relevant, there's an arrogance and a narcissism there saying, no, society should pay attention to our irrelevance. In other words, Jimmy Hoffa, does anybody, under 40 care or know anything about Jimmy Hoffa? Why don't you make a movie about Jay-Z, somebody relevant, why about Jimmy Hoffa? Only that's from your youth. And then the ultimate arrogance was the horrendous CGI de-aging effects, which literally rippled. And many people I've talked about who've noticed it, again, Emperor's New Clothes. Oh, well, I thought that was just, my TV. I'm like, well, then it's everybody's TV, and several critics have actually mentioned that, and then the arrogance of thinking that you can use a computer to make your face look 40 years younger. But then that you go to beat up a guy like you were that age and you move like a mummy. I mean, the whole thing I thought was pathetic. And even more pathetic, in my view, is that most critics are unwilling to call it for what it is. And this narcissism of making a 3.5-hour movie about issues no one cares about, I mean, it's so derivative of their youth. As a director, I noticed, the Steadicam continuous long shot of in Goodfellas when they go through the kitchen and then into the nightclub, that blew everyone away in 1980 something. So now, and he doesn't even see the irony of it. He does the same opening shot, but in a nursing home, with the main character rolling a wheelchair through being rolled in a wheelchair through a nursing home with that long shot and observing everybody. I mean, oh my goodness, please.
This is a weird question, but I'm going to base it on your film. If there's one reality star you could hang out with for a day, who would it be?
Well, that is a really interesting and fun question. Hang out with I have to say it's Paris Hilton, because I've just made a movie about her and I've studied her life, to fare thee well, and I've never met her. Well, I've seen her. I twice have run into her. Both times she was stumbling. One time she almost fell down the stairs at a L.A. restaurant called Madeo, because I presume she was intoxicated. And then another time she was sort of stumbling out of the Ivy. So that's the closest I've come to a Paris experience. But I think I would like to really see for myself up close and personal,
Well, thank you for coming back. We just want everybody to know that we had a little problem halfway through this, but Stephen was welcome to come back. We finished off this interview. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for letting me air my many strong opinions. I mean, as you can see, I'm not shy.
Yeah, no problem. I want everybody to check out Reality Queen. We've gone through all the cities, and if not, you'll find it somewhere. Just type it in, and it'll pop up on his website. You have a great night, sir, and thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay, bye-bye.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page. Thank you.